From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Bright Live With Herself? That's the question one of the authors of a scathing report which indicts the U.S., France, and the Catholic Church asks for failing to stop the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. And Israel's governing coalition collapses on the eve of this crucial Middle East peace summit at Camp David. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As U.S. consumers worry about the rising cost of gas, Nigerians are paying a heavier price. More than 250 villagers in the Niger Delta died in a pipeline explosion yesterday. Police sealed off the scene of Monday's explosion at Adaje village outside the oil city of Wari and close to Jessetown, where 1,000 people died in a similar disaster in 1998. The Niger Delta is crisscrossed with old, leaky oil pipelines that go unfixed by multinational oil corporations for decades. The companies use them to extract their wealth from Africa's most populous country. An African-American man was found hanged from a tree near a park yesterday in Bossier City, Louisiana, gagged, handcuffed, and wearing women's clothes. Police said the death was accidental and sexual in nature. Mike Halfen, spokesperson for the Bossier City Police, would give few details about the case but said specifically the man was not lynched. Television reporters said the man was about 19, wearing women's clothes. They also said he was gagged and handcuffed. Halfen refused to comment on the clothes, gags, or handcuffs. It was the second hanging of a young black man in recent weeks. The other was June 16th in Kokomo, Mississippi, when Raynard Johnson was found hanging from a tree in his yard. Medical examiners declared it a suicide. The Reverend Jesse Jackson called it a lynching because the teenager had been dating a white girl. This weekend, Jackson led nearly 1,000 people in a blistering sun to march along the country road in southern Mississippi and call for justice in the mysterious death of 17-year-old Raynard Johnson. The march ended hours later at what Jackson called the hanging tree, the small pecan tree on the front lawn of the Johnson family home where the popular youth was found hanging that night of June 16th. A 1996 photograph of New Jersey Governor Christy Todd Whitman frisking a black man during a drug sweep has sparked outrage from critics who say it's another example of racial profiling. Whitman has maintained her pat-down of the unidentified man while accompanying New Jersey State Police on a tour of Camden, the state's poorest city, was an attempt to understand the rigors of police work. Troopers had searched the man at least once during the sweep before offering him to the governor. A photograph obtained by the Associated Press shows Whitman, who appears to be smiling, standing behind a black man while his arms spread and his palms pressed up against a wall. The photograph taken by an officer was subpoenaed in May by several black and Latino troopers who claimed their superiors subjected them to discrimination. Both presidential candidates faced protesters yesterday. Anti-death penalty activists interrupted an introduction for George W. Bush at the NAACP National Convention in Washington, with one shouting, "An innocent man was murdered by Governor Bush." Security forces led the four or five protesters out after they waved signs with pictures of Gary Graham, also known as Shaka Sankofa, who was executed June 22nd in Texas. Graham, who was convicted largely on the testimony of one eyewitness, was the 135th prisoner executed since Bush became governor in 1995. "Remember Gary Graham," the protesters shouted as Bush was introduced, but before he began to speak. The NAACP has called the execution of Graham a gross travesty of justice and has called for a national moratorium on all executions. And this news from Knoxville, Tennessee. Environmental protesters took over Vice President Al Gore's East Tennessee campaign office yesterday, chaining themselves together for about 3 hours before leaving peacefully. The occupation comes just weeks before Republicans and Democrats hold their presidential nominating conventions, events expected to draw thousands of activists and protesters. When the office opened at 10, four women entered and tied themselves together with a motorcycle chain and several bicycle locks. At the same time, witnesses said about 100 others moved in front of the two-story building's entrance, and at least two more barricaded themselves on the roof with a banner that said, "The president is for hire." The protesters represented several groups who have campaigned against a wide variety of issues over the past year, including the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and protecting the environment. Leaders of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO have endorsed a large protest march on the eve of the Republican convention, and other unions are expected to follow suit next week. This according to union officials and rally organizers. The union endorsements, particularly the support of the 1 million member state AFL-CIO, could help boost participation and financial support for the Unity 2000 rally set for July 30th, the day before the four-day Republican convention begins in Philadelphia.
The killers of Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers of Butari must be sanitary workers. The savages of Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, 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 in the new world order. Like a dirty old bandage on the festering face of humanity. Old order unravel and reveal. Old scar just a broke out in a new soul. Primeval wound that time won't heal. And in the ancient currency of blood, tribal tyrants are set to world score. The killers of Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers of Butari must be sanitary workers. The savages of Shatila must be sanitary.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. An independent panel commissioned by the Organization of African Unity charged this weekend that the United States, France, and Belgium, as well as the Roman Catholic and Anglican churches, turned a blind eye to the mass killing of as many as 800,000 Rwandans in 1994. It concluded that the three governments should provide a significant level of reparations to the Central African country. The 318-page report challenged President Clinton's claim that the United States' failure to act in Rwanda was due to ignorance of the extent of the atrocities unfolding there, and it accuses Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who represented the United States in the UN Security Council at the time, of using stalling tactics to prevent a military rescue mission. State Department spokesperson Richard Boucher responded to the report by saying that Clinton and Albright have already voiced contrition for U.S. inaction. He declined to comment on the call for reparations. Washington's refusal to label what was happening in Rwanda genocide has been questioned for years. In June 1994, at a State Department press briefing, spokesperson Christine Shelley was asked how careful the State Department was not to say outright genocide.
As to the distinctions between the words, we're trying to call what we have seen so far as best as we can, and based, again, on the evidence, we have every reason to believe that acts of genocide have occurred.
How many acts of genocide does it take to make genocide?
Alan, that's just not a question that I'm in a position to answer.
It's true that you have specific guidance not to use the word genocide in isolation, but always to preface it with this word acts of.
I have guidance which I try to use as best as I can. I'm not. I have. There are formulations that we are using.
That was State Department spokesperson Christine Shelley back in 1994. Well, the seven-member panel called on UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to identify the countries that should pay reparations and to develop a plan to rebuild Rwanda, one of the world's poorest countries. It also recommends that Rwanda's foreign debt amassed by the former government that carried out the genocide should be canceled full. We're joined right now by three people to discuss the findings of this report. Ambassador Stephen Lewis is with us, a member of the Organization of African Unity panel that did the report. He's the former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations and a former UNICEF official. Ambassador Joseph Mutaboba is with us. He's Rwanda's ambassador to the United Nations. And Ambassador David Sheffer joins us from the State Department, the U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes. We're going to begin with Ambassador Stephen Lewis, who is part of the Organization of African Unity panel that put out this report. Can you summarize your findings?
Well, you summarized them not badly yourself, Amy. I guess the first thing that must obviously be said is that if there hadn't been a diabolical conspiracy on the part of some of the Hutu leadership to annihilate the Tutsi, the genocide would never have happened. And if the surrounding African countries in the period prior to the genocide in 1994 had been successful in handling the peace process, if it had been brought to a conclusion which could have prevented the genocide, then things would obviously never have happened or unfolded as they did. But everybody at the time made the same dreadful error in judgment. They thought that the civil war that was then raging in Rwanda was the problem, when in fact the problem was the genocide that was raging in Rwanda. We called our report the preventable genocide. We called it the preventable genocide because the evidence, and I want to emphasize this, tremendous mounds of evidence and testimony drove us irresistibly to the conclusion that the genocide could have been stopped before it started, particularly by the French government, which had intimate and inextricable relationships with the former government of Rwanda, had tremendous influence, and chose never to exert it. It could have been stopped before and during the genocide by the government of the United States, had they been willing to permit a major intervention, a major UN intervention force in Rwanda, as the head of the then UN force was desperately pleading for, and all his pleas fell on deaf ears. The sadness of hearing that quote from the State Department official that you just played in June of 94 is that by that time, fully 500,000 people were dead. And there was no question for the world that a genocide was occurring. And that was such a quintessential quote because it captures exactly the U.S. position. They spent the entire period of the genocide pretending that it wasn't happening and preventing the United Nations from making a major intervention. And unfortunately, the UN Secretariat didn't act or didn't mobilize itself as vigorously as it should, so that in a sense, all of those who could have stopped the genocide, including the church, which was close to Hutu power, including the Belgians who pulled their troops out at the moment their peacekeepers were killed in the first 24 hours, just as the United States had left Somalia in a similar situation. Everything conspired to make or to permit the genocide to happen, which is one of the great tragedies of the last decade of the 20th century.
And explain how long did the genocide take and exactly how many people, of course you don't know exactly, died?
Well, the genocide took roughly 100 days. It went from April the 6th, 1994, to the middle of July, 1994. And I think the estimates, these figures, because they're human beings, are more than the mind can absorb, but it ranges from 500,000 to 800,000 on the basis of all the most authentic material. I just want to emphasize that although there may have been no moment precisely in time when you could say a group of people got together to plan the genocide, the unfolding of events, the reports of the catastrophe that was looming, what all of the capitals of the world knew, Washington, Brussels, Paris, because their diplomats were sending back the information. It was a little incestuous diplomatic community in Kigali. They shared everything. What you learned Tuesday morning, you knew by Tuesday night. The complete abandonment of Rwanda at the point when its people were being exterminated is simply something that is unbearable, Amy. I don't know how to deal with it simply in a conversation.
We're talking to Ambassador Stephen Lewis, formerly the Canadian ambassador to the United Nations. What about specifically Madeleine Albright and her role now Secretary of State here in the United States, of course, then the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations?
Amy, Ambassador Albright, in response to the report, has said that she thought the report was inaccurate in its depiction of the United States. I have never felt so certain about a position in my in a life of feeling certain about positions. I think the evidence is just overwhelming. It's quoted chapter and verse in the report. Madeleine Albright said that she has apologized and expressed remorse, as has President Clinton. That's fair enough, although apologies are by no means enough. Both President Clinton and Madeleine Albright say that they were largely ignorant of what was happening. I don't think that's accurate. Madeleine Albright has said that it would be impossible to get UN troops in fast enough. Things were unfolding too quickly. Amy, within 48 hours, there were between 1,000 and 2,000 foreign troops in Kigali, 48 hours of the massacres beginning, because they wanted to evacuate their foreign nationals. When France decided to go to the southwest quadrant of Rwanda at the end of the genocide with its so-called Operation Turquoise, it took them 48 hours to get their troops there with a full UN Security Council mandate. It's just poppycock to pretend that you can't move troops around quickly and in large numbers when the industrial world decides it wants to do so. Finally, Madeleine Albright says she was screaming about the way in which the Americans were mishandling the genocide. She thought their policies were wrong. Now, here I have great trouble. If the screaming went on in Washington, I want to tell you it was absolutely inaudible in the rest of the world. Madeleine Albright, with a zeal which was virtually supernatural, pursued the mandate of preventing the UN from entering Rwanda in large numbers. She did it with a determined, methodical prosecution of her brief. In a way, I was an ambassador at the UN, in a way few ambassadors do. I would have thought that there comes a point in the life of a public servant, of a diplomat, where if you know that the results of your government's inaction would mean the death of 500,000 to 800,000 people, which became early and clearly evident, then either you resign as a matter of principle, or you yell from the rooftops. You don't share the animus of your views quietly in the corridors of Washington. And that's what disturbed the panel about Madeleine Albright.
Ambassador David Sheffer, U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes, joining us from the State Department. Your response to Ambassador Stephen Lewis and this scathing OAU report.
Well, first let me say that in late 1997, it was Madeleine Albright who appointed as Secretary of State, actually called for the creation of this OAU group of eminent personalities. So she has strongly supported from the very beginning this very study. We have looked forward to its release for quite some time. What I find a little surprising is that I'm somewhat surprised at the presumptions that Ambassador Lewis reflects in his comments, and which are also reflected in portions of the report. A large part of the report is actually quite good, but it does leap to assumptions about the intentions of policymakers and the intentions of decisions by governments, which we certainly consider to be unwarranted with respect to the United States government. So that's a serious flaw in the report, of those presumptions.
Well, I'm gonna...
You know, we had this group in Washington for a couple of days, and I remember spending a considerable amount of time with them and working through almost on a week-by-week basis what occurred during the genocide as well as the weeks prior to it. And It's unfortunate that I find almost none of the perspectives that we provided the group in this report. If those perspectives had been recorded, then the report, I think, would have been much more accurate with respect to what actually occurred.
Ambassador David Sheffer, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but you can continue with your response after that break. We're talking about the report that has just come out from a panel of eminent personalities, as they're called, of the Organization of African Unity on the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, when at least 800,000 people died in 100 days. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the report just released from an Organization of African Unity panel on the Rwandan genocide of 1994, particularly focusing on the role of the United States, France, the Catholic and Anglican churches in that genocide. We're joined by three ambassadors, Ambassador Stephen Lewis, formerly the Canadian ambassador to the UN, who is part of the group of people who did the report. Ambassador Joseph Mutabobo will be joining us in just a minute, Rwanda's ambassador to the United Nations. And Ambassador David Sheffer is with us from the State Department, U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes. You were criticizing the report, Ambassador Sheffer, as you talked about the discussion of intentions. But what about the U.S. government stopping the Security Council from authorizing a peacekeeping force from moving into Rwanda before the genocide?
Well, we have acknowledged that during those first 2 weeks of the genocide, we had two very clear priorities. And we've always, you know, we've described this as our conventional response to an unconventional crisis, and we've learned lessons from that. But the conventional response was first get all Americans out of there, and secondly, protect the peacekeepers themselves. And if that means actually removing the peacekeepers, then given the fact that the donor countries were demanding that they be removed, then we had to respond to that, particularly Belgium's demand that its peacekeepers be removed. We were also very closely in contact with the Secretary General and with Kofi Annan, who at that time was head of the peacekeeping operations. And I can assure you that in those early weeks, we were so closely in contact with them that the actions that we were taking in the Security Council very much reflected their thinking. Now, it did occur that when we took the step, I guess in about the second week or so of the genocide, to propose, you know, withdrawing the entire peacekeeping force because of the violence that was erupting, and it did not have a mandate to deal with that violence, nor the training to do so, that it encountered dissent with it by some members of the council. So we put our proposal aside, we sat down with the members, and we started working along with the Secretary General on how to keep a peacekeeping force there in a manner that was going to be acceptable to the membership of the Security Council. So, you know, when we look back at how we acted at that time, it's clear in hindsight that it would have been preferable to have perhaps acted in a somewhat different way to try to shore up the peacekeeping effort with forces that in fact could take on that kind of mandate under those circumstances more quickly than was the result. But at the time, And under the circumstances at the time, we were dealing with a lot of recommendations coming from the donor countries themselves, from the Secretary General, from the head of peacekeeping operations. And also we were dealing with you know, what we ourselves were capable of doing on a short notice. I think we've learned from the experience two major things. First, that when there is a lot of mass killing unfolding, you have to consider dynamic military options much more quickly than we did so at that time. We acknowledge that. We have to act more quickly to consider how to respond militarily in real time in an unconventional crisis, as opposed to sort of a conventional, as the Ambassador Lewis says, civil war scenario. Secondly, there's been a tremendous amount of misrepresentation and confusion about the use of the word genocide by the U.S. government. And this tape from June is a classic tape, and we've often talked about it. She did say acts of genocide, and you know, in retrospect, we should have clarified with the spokeswoman, you know, acts of genocide is genocide. Don't try to fudge the distinction. But at the time, we just didn't get that clarified. We were very, very prepared as of mid-May to take the position that genocide was occurring in Rwanda. We made that decision internally, and then our spokespeople were instructed to that effect, but it just got a little bungled in the way it was actually delivered when actually asked by the press.
Well, let me ask Ambassador Stephen Lewis, do you think it was bungled, or do you think that that was deliberate? Because to say the actual word genocide without the qualified acts of would trigger a process that would mean peacekeepers moving in. Ambassador Lewis?
Oh, I'm sorry that somebody had knocked at my door and I got distracted for a second. I was inclined to think that nobody knew whether the genocide convention could be triggered at any point. It was always said that the United States was faintly uncomfortable, that if it admitted to genocide, then certain obligations would follow. I'm not sure that the genocide convention imposes those obligations except in a moral sense. But I must say that it's a little difficult for me, forgive my incredulity, it's a little difficult for me to believe that in the middle of, well, I believe it, but just to apply it, that in the middle of May you come to a conclusion that you're in the middle of a genocide and your spokespeople in June, the next month, are still using acts of genocide in a way which is clearly so uncomfortable that they become a laughingstock. So there was something wrong, generally, with the way in which the United States responded to this.
Well, let me bring in Rwanda's ambassador to the United Nations, Joseph Mutaboba. At the time, in 1994, where were you, Ambassador?
At the time, I was in London. But at the height of a genocide in the month of May and June, I was at the border between Burundi and Rwanda trying to cater for those who had survived, having the primary information from those who had just survived from the genocide. So I was operating from Burundi, and I went back to London to compile that in a different kind of reports.
Ambassador Mutaboba, what is your response to the report?
Well, Helen, this report is yet again another report, but the difference it has with the previous ones, and I'm talking of the report from Belgium, the one from France, and the latest, which was the Carson report, the difference it has with them and from them is that it goes to the point and clearly dead to the core, a spade a spade. When I look at the responsibilities as they are expressed, they put more weight at condemning the Security Council, which was not done in clear terms by the previous reports. And I find it to be a very positive kind of move to do so. Because for the time being, as you know, people have tended to be more apologetic rather than accepting facts. And here there's no speculation to be made, because we are talking of facts. What did Ambassador Lewis just described a few minutes ago, and what David Schaeffer was saying, is exactly a fact. So if Washington, for example, failed to use the word genocide in time, and yet they had diplomats in town, Kigali, if in the Security Council they failed to stop the ambassador from Rwanda, who was sitting there trying to convince and lobby, as you know, not to use the word genocide, that's a big mistake. If at the same time all the forces which were on the ground, French, Americans, Belgians, could not stop and jam the radio, RTLM. So all of these are facts. So you cannot speculate and exempt somebody from what happened. That would be just a blind amnesty, as I could say. But I'm not wish hunting here. I'm just trying to say that the facts are there. They speak for themselves. There's nothing new as far as the report is concerned. It is telling us exactly what we said before, but the world will not believe that it happened. So that's what I see as a kind of strong point of the report.
Ambassador Stephen Lewis, the OAU report also criticizes the current government of Rwanda, which Ambassador Mutaboba represents. What were your concerns about its role?
Our concerns were the potential for human rights violations. There had been many accusations about the government of Rwanda. We talked about this very, very frankly in Rwanda. We met with then Vice President Kagame and the President and members of the Cabinet, and we had two very, very extensive discussions where we were very, very frank as a panel in saying to them, there are strong allegations of human rights violations at two points in time. One, when the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the current government, as it were, invaded Rwanda from Uganda in October of 1990 and moved south through the country, engaged in this civil war, and then in attempting to prevent the genocide. And then after the huge refugee exodus into what was then Zaire, and Rwanda, the present government of Rwanda, in tracking down the genocidaire, in attempting to disarm the refugee camps, was also accused of engaging in human rights violations, quite massive on occasion, in those efforts. Now, we looked again at all of the reports of the international human rights bodies. We looked at all of the material that we could get our hands on from within the Secretariat. We talked to the United Nations High Commission on Refugee People. We did everything we could to ascertain from the literature and from direct evidence what we thought was the most honest finding. And we said, and we were brokenhearted to have to say it, because you don't want to have to say it, that we found very real evidence of major human rights violations on the part of the present government of Rwanda, particularly post-genocide in the Kivus, in what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now, let me say that the panel understands that until Rwanda's borders are secure, there will always be these depredations. And another terrible failure of the international community was the failure to disarm the refugee camps in the then Zaire, because it was an invitation to the genocidaire to continue to attack Rwanda from the base within the now Congo. So we know that has to be resolved. That's still what's plaguing the whole Great Lakes region. But we did identify human rights violations in the process, and we felt we had to say so, because we weren't going to write a report which wasn't driven to conclusions by the evidence.
Ambassador Mutaboba, your response. Ambassador.
Here I have no intention whatsoever of going on to the defensive, but come back to the point Ambassador Lewis made, that if you look back at what happened, the chronological events that occurred during the time of the liberation of Rwanda, during the genocide and after genocide, it is very evident that Rwanda and the RPF especially had been left to themselves. There was no some kind of assistance whatsoever as far as the stopping of the massacres and everything was going on. So when we stopped the genocide in July 1994 and the forces of the Imani regime crossed into Congo, we said it clearly. We said, look, you have all these evil forces crossing into a foreign territory, armed as they were, and trained as they went to be, and rearmed as the evidence showed afterwards. We always said, you are simply just sitting on a bomb shell. So what happened later on, and what is happening even today, proved us right. We were right to say, and we were right to call on the entire international community, including the Security Council, to say, please make sure that you stop this this trend of events. You have the killers who are still at large, who are still killing, who are still planning to kill more. Do something. Nothing was done. And when we stopped it ourselves in 1996, you know, and everyone knows, how many accusations we had against us by human rights organizations, by some European countries, and any other bodies you can think of, you have that on the record. And I find this to be rather a kind of a double standard going on. Here you are, the international community fails all along, fails Rwanda, and the Rwanda tries to find a solution, and in the path, or on the path of the finding that solution, of course we are not saying that our soldiers were as seemed as what it can be. It's impossible to say that, especially when they were fighting with the whole population. The population was armed as a civilian in their army. The militia, there are some who had military uniforms on. There are some who did not have any on and still were armed. So how do you differentiate between the who is the fighter who is not? So in the course of events, it is true, and we regret that many people, their lives have been lost, but we cannot take it as a systematic violation of intended violation of human rights. That would be wrong, and I wish that everybody could come back to one senses and judge the situation from facts and then from speculation.
Are you calling for reparations, Ambassador Mutaboba?
Well, I think I have already lost my voice many times in the UN and everywhere else. And my fellow countrymen and the government said the same. We think that in the wake of what happened in Rwanda, the world should put their hands on their hearts and say, we went wrong, we were wrong. And rather than being defensive, what can we do now? We cannot dwell on the past for a long time. What can we do for that country to rebuild itself? What can we do to help that country, the government, to stop cutting itself in 10 pieces and so on? Whatever we can do to help, that would add more sense to what to do in the future. And what can we do to change the work of the way the Security Council works? You know, we don't seem to have learned any lessons.
Ambassador Stephen Lewis, in the recommendations, you call for reparations. Exactly what?
What we were suggesting, we mentioned the experience of Germany after the Second World War. We were using that simply as a way of looking at how the reparations might be cast. We asked the Secretary General to see if he couldn't devise a formula, and there is a document on recommendation on reparations, which ironically just went to the Economic and Social Council of the UN a few months ago, a document on which a formula might be based. Our call for reparations is really for money that would go to rebuilding the economic and social infrastructure of Rwandan society, of reparations that would apply to the state as a whole. Rwanda itself has established a fund for the survivors, to which it contributes 5% of its very small budget, and to which I think other countries in the world who were in part responsible for observing the genocide and doing nothing, other countries should contribute to that survivors fund, because that goes directly to the people affected. But our call for reparations as such was a broader call modeled on the kind of pattern of the money that Germany paid to Israel at the end of the war as a way of rebuilding the entire society rather than identifying the money on the basis of individual people.
I want to get the response of Ambassador David Sheffer to the call for reparations, but we do have to break, and we'll do that when we come back. Then we're going to look at the Middle East Peace Summit taking place in Camp David, Maryland. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're speaking to Ambassador Stephen Lewis, former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations and now member of the OAU panel that did the report on the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Also, Rwanda's Ambassador Joseph Mutaboba is with us, the ambassador to the United Nations. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we wrap up this discussion of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, where 800,000 to a million people died in a 100-day period. We're talking to one of the authors of that report, Ambassador Stephen Lewis, a former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations, also former high-level UNICEF official, Ambassador Joseph Mutaboba, Rwanda's ambassador to the United Nations, and Ambassador David Sheffer, U.S. Ambassador-at-Large for War Crimes, speaking to us from the State Department. What about this call for reparations, Ambassador Sheffer?
Well, unfortunately, it's an erroneous use of the word reparations. Reparations has a long history in international law, and it particularly refers to payments that are due when there has been a violation of the laws of war. That's how it started almost a century ago. And, of course, reparations were required of Germany after World War I and after World War II, but it relates essentially to the state responsibility, or with particular emphasis on individuals, criminal responsibility for violations of the laws of war. That's not what is at issue in Rwanda, and the presumption that pervades in parts of this report that somehow there was actually a conspiracy on the part of governments to fuel the genocide, that there was, as Ambassador Lewis said, he said, pretending that it wasn't happening, all of that is so far off the mark that when you talk about how to recover from the genocide, talking about reparations from foreign governments is simply an inaccurate terminology. I think we would have been very comfortable if that whole section of the report that focuses on reparations would have recast it as the responsibility of governments to provide levels of foreign assistance to Rwanda to help it rebuild its society. And the United States, we wish we could be providing more money than we do to Rwanda, but we do provide a fair amount of foreign assistance to Rwanda. We've been one of the major, if not the major, foreign contributor to the Survivors Fund that was mentioned by Ambassador Lewis. And we have many other programs that impact Rwanda that we're providing financial support for. But I think a report like this can highlight the need to rebuild a society to help the victims, to ensure that they can restore their lives, and that's accomplished under these circumstances with increased foreign assistance. But reparations is a totally inaccurate term.
Amy, if I may very quickly,
Ambassador Lewis.
A slight smile was forming at the edge of my lips as I thought perhaps Ambassador Sheffer would be more comfortable if I'd used the phrase acts of reparations. the fact of the matter is that we don't have to get into a kind of arcane legal acumen here. The truth is that the meaning of our words were clear, whether it is expressed by way of foreign assistance or whether it is expressed by way of a special levy on those countries who can afford it. What is clear in the report is that the use of the word reparations is meant to compensate Rwanda for the grievous harm that was done when the world community failed to intervene as they might have intervened. I don't want to get into an argument with David Sheffer, but there has been an extraordinary amount of historical revisionism about what took place during that genocide. And I want to just leave you, Amy, with one point. On May the 17th, in the middle of the genocide, the Security Council voted to set up what they called UNAMIR II, the second UN peacekeeping operation, with 5,500 men and a significant additional amount of armament and armored personnel carriers, 50 in total. The United States, and the United States alone, was able to provide those carriers, and the world witnessed a most extraordinary phenomenon of deciding what symbol should go on those carriers, what they should be painted, how they would get there, how the men would get there. And from May the 17th till the end of the genocide, Amy, in the middle of July, not a single additional piece of equipment got to Rwanda. Not one single additional UN peacekeeper got to Rwanda. For 2 months, the world stalled. And grievously, unhappily, that stalling was led by the United States. Those are historical facts. I don't even like saying them, but they're all on the record. And I think a country with as much power and force, and at many times in its history, the moral legitimacy of the United States, has to recognize that it has a lot to answer for.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up because we're moving on to the Middle East summit that is taking place now at Camp David. Our guests, the three ambassadors, thank you for being with us. Ambassador Stephen Lewis, a member of the Organization of African Unity panel that put out the report. Ambassador Joseph Mutaboba, Rwanda's ambassador to the United Nations. And Ambassador David Sheffer, U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes, speaking to us from the State Department. If you want to get a hold of this more than 300-page report, you can go to the web at www.oau-oua.org. That's www.oau-oua.org. As we move on now to our last segment, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian President Yasser Arafat began a Middle East summit with President Bill Clinton at Camp David today. Before leaving for the United States, Barak faced down an unruly parliament, surviving a vote of no confidence just hours before leaving for the talks. The opposition Likud party failed to muster the 61 votes that would have ousted Barak. 54 members voted for the motion of no confidence. Nonetheless, many observers are saying Barak arrives today in Washington alone. Three right-wing and religious parties, including Barak's largest coalition partner, announced they're quitting the government, drastically reducing Barak's support in parliament from a sound majority to a minority. Several key ministers in his cabinet handed in letters of resignation. Foreign Minister David Levy announced he'll boycott the U.S.-hosted talks. Analysts and newspapers in Israel said the defections were triggered by Barak's failure to build a consensus before the summit and by a perception in the conservative wing of the coalition that he would turn over too much West Bank land to the Palestinians at the bargaining table. We're joined now by Phyllis Bennis, senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who's just returned from 3 weeks in the West Bank, and Ambassador Clovis Maksoud, director of the Center of the Global South at American University, former ambassador for the Arab League to the United Nations and the United States. Ambassador Clovis Maksoud, what is Yasser Arafat looking for at this Camp David Middle East summit?
Well, I think he's looking for some sort of being shielded out by the summit from the attempts by President Clinton to persuade him to do more concessions than he has done, to sort of deviate from the consensus that has emerged by the Palestinian National Council's meeting last week in order to extract more concessions as if to protect what the president is going to try and tell him that this is the ultimately the peacemaker. And I think Mr. Barak is going to say that under the circumstances of the dismantling of his coalition, that he can no longer be in any further accommodating mood, and that his insistence on the 5 points, what is called the red zones, about refugees, about Jerusalem, about settlements, about the borders, are not to be touched. And I think that that is a prescription, if not for a breakdown, at least for a momentary deadlock. And I think President Clinton is going to try to maybe not achieve the breakthrough that he was hoping for, but at least to say that there would be a continuation of a peace process, but that some agreement on the framework of the and guidelines of the ultimate solution should be spelled out in this summit meeting. But I don't think that the framework is always a loose terminology which gives Israel the pretext to interpret it the way it wants. And I think that the Palestinian consensus at this moment is not in any disposition to accommodate Mr. Barak, who is going to shield himself from further attack by the right wing by adopting a right-wing agenda.
Phyllis Bennis, you've just returned from the West Bank. What do people there want and expect from this summit?
Well, you know, Amy, I think the irony of the summit beginning right now is that Barak comes here having lost a great deal of official support, but with a recognized widespread mandate of popular support. Yasser Arafat comes with the support of some of his officials who will be coming here with him, but having lost a great deal of public confidence and public support. What people on the West Bank are very concerned about is that the official position that's asserted over and over again by Arafat and other representatives of the Palestine Authority will not, in fact, be their bargaining position. The authority is maintaining on the public level that they are committed to a return of all of the West Bank and Gaza, East Jerusalem as the Palestinian capital, the dismantling of all settlements, and crucially, the right of return of all the refugees. That's generally understood to be to represent the Palestinian consensus, and in fact, it represents a major set of concessions already, given that the West Bank and Gaza together only constitute 22% of historic Palestine. But what everyone that I spoke to, particularly in the refugee camps, where fears are rising about being abandoned, being left behind by the negotiators, what people are afraid of is that those claimed positions will fall away very rapidly, and that an agreement will be made for less than all of the West Bank, for a capital in Abu Dis, which is a town outside of Jerusalem. It's an astonishing thing that's being touted in the press as a great concession on the Israeli part and a great acceptance on the Palestinian part, that they would expand, the Israelis would expand their official borders of Jerusalem to include a couple of small towns outside of Jerusalem, but nearby, and then announce that one of those towns could become the Palestinian capital and could be named El-Quds. The naming would be the concession. It's as if saying that San Francisco's borders would be expanded to include the little town across the bay of Emeryville, and then you could declare Emeryville to be San Francisco, when the whole world knows that Emeryville is not San Francisco. Palestinians all know that Abu Dis is not Jerusalem. They want a capital in Jerusalem. They want a dismantling of the settlements. And they want land which is not only a question of percentages, but that is contiguous and viable. You could have, for instance, 85 or even 90% of the land of the West Bank returned to the Palestinian Authority. But if that 5% is what it is today, in the form largely of bypass roads, access roads, bridges, tunnels, and other means of dividing up that Palestinian land, you don't have a viable state. What you have are cantons. What you have are truncated Bantustans surrounded by Israeli troops. So the numbers that get thrown out in many ways are a diversion from the reality of what people are looking for. I'm afraid that the kinds of concessions that the Palestinian Authority will make under enormous pressure from the Clinton administration will be far more than what could be accepted by the Palestinian population, and what we're likely to be left with is some version of a permanent interim solution, so that President Clinton will get his photo op that he so desperately wants for his legacy. The Palestinians will get a promise that some future time there will be another chance to renegotiate, and the Israelis will get some level of a sign-off for what they want, which is a declared end to the conflict.
And what about the announcement of an independent state that is expected to come by September 14th, Ambassador Maksoud?
Well, the paradox of it is that there has been a Palestinian state declared in 1988 and recognized by a significant number of countries. It was a state under occupation, which is a legal definition of what the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem are. And that is why they now the Palestinian Council is insisting on implementing Security Council Resolution 242. The unfortunate part is that the Oslo Agreement has more or less marginalized this legal equation that existed and could have been a subject of negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. However, what happened is that the Oslo Agreement sort of sidestepped this legal base of an occupied territory, because Israel does not acknowledge that it is in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem an occupying power, and therefore not accountable to the Fourth Geneva Convention. And that is why it keeps on proliferating and beefing up settlements, annexing more territories in Jerusalem and others, on the basis that there is no legal status, and that at best the Palestinians and the Israelis have sort of equal legal claims into that territory. And that is the basic flaw that has delayed the negotiations from having any credible and lasting outcome. And therefore, the declaration of the Palestinian state over the entirety of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem as the capital is the minimum that the Palestinian would be able to develop a consensus that would make the peace durable.
Let me ask Phyllis Bennis as we wrap up. Do you think that Yasser Arafat could return to another intifada, an intifada both against Israel and against the PLO leadership?
Unfortunately, I don't think that's something that can be wiped out of the realm of possibilities. I don't think that it's certain that he will sign the kind of concessions that people on the ground are so afraid of. The key issue, and I think what it's important for people to be watching, is what happens to the refugees. It's not only what the New York Times this morning called the mantra of the Palestinian leadership to call for the right of return for all the refugees of 1948 as well as 1967. It's also the basis of international law, UN Resolution 194, that has been signed off on every year since that time until 1994 by the United States. That has since been dropped out of the equation. But until there is an acceptance of the right of return, not simply a humanitarian willingness on Israel's part to accept a few tens of thousands of Palestinians to return home, but acknowledgement of the right that remains in international law, I don't think we're going to have what Clovis Maksoud just spoke of as a durable peace.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Ambassador Clovis Maksoud heads the Center for the Global South at American University, formerly the Ambassador for the Arab League to the UN and to the United States. Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Today we move from Rwanda to tomorrow, Nigeria. We'll be joined by a young Nigerian feminist, and she'll talk about the death toll that's continuing to rise in the Niger Delta from leaky pipeline explosions as the U.S. consumers are concerned about increase in oil prices here. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill, Anthony Sloaner, engineer. Thanks to Robert Knight. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.